Martin versus Evans, Ms. Kostolecki.
Good morning. May it please the court. This is a habeas corpus appeal in which the errors in the lower courts caused Mr. Martin to be convicted of first-degree murder rather than involuntary manslaughter. District court order denying Martin habeas relief should be reversed. Ineffective assistance of appellate counsel. Appellate counsel appealed an issue that was barred by a statute and ignored winning arguments that should have been raised that could have resulted in involuntary manslaughter conviction. Appellate counsel argued.
What are the winners? I didn't really see that. What would be a winner?
There are three, Your Honor. The first is ineffective assistance of trial counsel. And that one, the issue there was failure, a couple of issues. Failure to prevent or impeach or dilute Ms. Carr's testimony.
I didn't understand that. Is that the business about the difference between nobody will have her and nobody will want her?
Well, there are a couple
so
of
subtle. I missed that completely.
There are a couple of issues in relation to Ms. Carr. That one is particularly important because
that I do not understand. That was almost like a kind of sick humor that by saying nobody will want her, he was just expressing a desire to slash her face. But of course, you don't slash a face by squeezing a person. I don't see the connection.
There are two different incidents, Your Honor. The first one, with respect to the slashing the face, was the one that occurred in August of 91, and that's where the statements come out. Those didn't occur during the incident that caused her, that resulted in her death.
What kind of person wants to slash her face? I don't understand how that's going to endear him with the jury.
Trial counsel was trying to keep out the original. Absolutely, Your Honor. We were trying to keep the entire incident out, and that is the point of the ineffective assistance of trial counsel.
You mean because he didn't keep it out?
Yes, she was unable, because of her lack of preparation.
How would you keep it out if you prepared yourself very diligently? He says he accidentally strangled her, but earlier he had slashed her face and said he wanted to kill her. How would you keep that out?
Well, the way to keep it out was to argue that the incidents were different, and also that...
They're different, but they clearly bear on his attitude and intent in the latter, in the strangulation.
I don't think Clarence Darrow could have kept it out, just to tell the truth.
Well, perhaps it wouldn't have been kept out, Your Honor, but the point is that counsel never made an effort.
Right. But if you give us the winning argument he would have made before the court, then we might be able to go down the road with you. What is the argument that he would say that would keep it out?
Well, it wouldn't be just a single thing. This is a situation where the cumulative errors of trial counsel would have resulted in a reversal.
No, we're trying to keep out that slashing.
Yeah. How do you keep... You just give us how you keep it out, other than say it was different and then saying they were two separate incidents.
At the point when the motion for other crimes evidence was made, counsel should have, in the first instance, read the cases that the prosecutors brought forth, which she didn't do. She admitted that she hadn't done.
Well, your quotations actually were pretty incomplete. I mean, when the context was restored, it seemed that she knew the principle, even if she didn't remember the cases.
And so what is the winning case that her research would have revealed had she been prepared, or a case that even gets you a 50-50 chance of keeping it out?
I think that having read People versus Ilgen and that line of cases would have given her a 50-50 chance.
And what does that line of cases say?
The cases discuss when circumstances in which evidence of other crimes is admissible. She could have made the arguments that in the People versus Ilgen the facts were very different, that was a gun case and there were repeated incidents when...
The real fact, though, it goes in to show whether or not it was an accident. He says he strangled her accidentally, right?
Absolutely.
But prior to that, months prior to that, he broke into her house, slashed her face, and indicated he wanted to kill the bitch, if I remember correctly.
But
now, how are you going to keep that out when you're talking about the motivation?
Your Honor, the difference, Your Honor, is that in the incident that resulted in her death, he was at his own home. She came to his home.
But the issue is what caused the death? Was he dead? Did he do it on purpose? Or was he just wrestling with her? Was he trying to fight her off? That's the issue, right?
Yes.
Why is it not significant that he tried to slash or did slash her, apparently tried to kill her before?
Well, I think it resulted in a litany or a chain of errors that occurred. And of course,
I still don't know how you're going to keep it out. That piece of evidence strikes me as being remarkably admissible.
Well, then even if the evidence came in, the point is that
you would have made a good tip. You would have gone down drowning.
Had trial counsel had an opportunity to prepare, she would have known that Ms. Carr was going to testify. If I can't have her, can nobody have her? She didn't even know that. She had no idea. She relied on the prosecutor's statement that the police report was entirely consistent with the little girl's testimony, and the fact of the matter was that it wasn't.
But it's such an inconspicuous difference. I don't understand.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. It's not insignificant if you're the person that's on trial for first-degree murder.
No, the point is, looking at the language, his point is, here's the first quote, if I can't have you, can nobody have you? And the second one, the difference, one that's supposed to be so different is, if I can't have you, that's, so the first five words are the same, nobody's going to want you. So it's the difference between nobody's going to want you and can nobody have you. So what's different about that?
One, nobody's going to want you indicates you would be unattractive, nobody's going to want you. Can nobody...
That's the slashing theory.
Yes.
That all you want to do is slash you.
Yes.
I mean, that's ridiculous. I mean, can you imagine getting up and saying, look, he didn't want to kill her, he just wanted to slash her face. It's very dangerous to start slashing a person's face. You slash her neck, you know, you can kill her. So I don't see how a jury would be impressed by this kind of refined distinction. I'm not a murderer, I just disfigure people.
Yes, John, and perhaps they wouldn't have believed that distinction. But the point here is that...
How would it make a difference, right?
It would have made a difference because had trial counsel investigated into that issue and investigated more, into the August of 91 incident in its entirety, she would have known about the distinctions.
But
she
it's so minor. I don't see how you can show prejudice from this.
Moreover,
I think, you know, you always, it's kind of this razor's edge thing. I mean, suppose the lawyer had cross-examined the child and brought out this distinction and said, you know, my client, he just wanted to slash her face and disfigure her. He didn't want to kill her. You'd come up here and argue. That was a ridiculous thing to say to a jury. That was terrible. Right? So...
But the point is, Your Honor...
You're a lawyer. I mean, you have a very hard case, so you have to make these judgments. And it's just not obvious that getting into this distinction would be a good way to help your client.
But counsel never had an opportunity to make those judgments because counsel...
That doesn't matter. Look, you have to show prejudice. You have to show that if he made different judgments, which might have been better judgments, they would have made a difference. It's not clear they would have been better judgments or it would have made a difference. Draw attention to the fact your client is a slasher? How's that going to help you?
Because it points out the distinction.
Well, yeah, but I know, but it sounds just ridiculous. The jury isn't going to say, oh, he's just a slasher, fine. So he wouldn't strangle her if he all wanted to do was disfigure her. It doesn't sound right.
But that allowed the bloody lash charge to go to the jury. Jury during deliberations. It also allowed the prosecutor to misrepresent the real facts during the closing arguments. It allowed a number of other things to occur. Had counsel prepared, perhaps none of that would have ever happened.
But if you wanted to make an issue of his being a slasher, that would make the glass shard the more relevant, right?
I see I'm out of time. Do you want me to continue with the discussion?
No, you can reserve the rest of your time. Prefer.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Kostolecki. Mr. Weaver?
Mm-hmm. May it please the court.
For your response, if you're waiting for me to say I'm pleased, go ahead.
Counsel, thank you, Your Honor. This court has indicated that when a procedural question and a constitutional issue are both certified for appeal, it will resolve the procedural question first. Consistent with that general rule, I begin with the proposition that the district court properly deemed the following three claims procedurally defaulted in accordance with the independent inadequate state ground doctrine. One, that trial counsel was ineffective. Two, that the trial court erred in permitting the weapon from the prior crime to go back to the jury during deliberations. And three, that the trial court erred in permitting the state to cross-examine petitioner about other crimes or events that it could not prove. The state post-conviction circuit court, in a detailed written memorandum opinion, concluded that these three claims were waived for the purpose of post-conviction review because they involved matters of record which could have been raised on direct appeal. That invocation of a valid state procedural bar provides the ground for barring federal habeas relief. Although this case then proceeded to the Illinois Appellate Court on a motion to withdraw in accordance with Pennsylvania versus Finley, the appellate court order granting that motion and affirming the denial of habeas relief, affirming the denial of post-conviction relief, should be understood as an endorsement or a affirmation of that lower court's invocation of the procedural bar, the rule of waiver. For that reason, it's respondent's position that this court's opinion in Wilkinson should not apply and does not apply in the instant context. If this court determines that the district court did in fact properly deem those claims defaulted, it's necessary to address petitioner's argument that the ineffective assistance of appellate counsel served as cause to excuse that default. Because the ineffective assistance claim itself fails on the merits as a habeas claim, it similarly follows that that claim also fails as an assertion of cause. Petitioner's response in her reply brief to that argument is that to invite this court to review the cause claim through a de novo standard of review rather than the deferential lens mandated by the AEDPA. Rather, the appropriate way of addressing that claim is to provide it deference, provided the AEDPA standard of review as such analysis is consistent with the rule announced by the United States Supreme Court in its Edwards opinion. In Edwards, the court indicated that if a petitioner is asserting the ineffective assistance of counsel as cause, that petitioner must have also raised that claim as an independent constitutional claim in the state court, and therefore that claim is subject to the rules of procedural default. If, as in this case, that has occurred, the petitioner has satisfied the burden of Edwards and has raised that claim independently in state court, and the state court has then taken the opportunity to address that claim, to adjudicate that claim on the merits, then that state court's adjudication of the claim should be entitled to AEDPA deference.
I want to talk about the glass shard because the witness was able to testify about it and the incident. What relevant purpose did it really have? Wasn't it really inflammatory and really served no purpose to further the prosecution's case?
Well, I suppose the purpose of that piece of evidence was in regard to whether or not petitioner could have had the intent to commit first-degree murder in this case.
Well, Carr testified to what happened with the shard.
Correct.
So that evidence was in. So I'm asking specifically why wasn't the shard just admitted just to inflame the jury?
Well, did the shard, pardon me, excuse me, maybe I clarify for myself. Did the shard go back to the jury room?
The shard did go back to the jury
room. And that's the beef. Not that the shard would be admissible, but not back in the jury room. Is that's the posture?
Right.
Why'd it go back to the jury room? You wouldn't send a knife back or a gun back.
Dangerous.
You don't know you weren't there.
That's right. That's right. I was not there. But I will point out that...
aren't you glad some juror didn't get himself all slashed up in the process?
Again,
the holdout, sir.
I don't know particularly why exactly that it was sent back to the jury again.
You're not defending it, you're just saying it didn't cause any reversible error.
That's right, no Strickland prejudice, exactly. Even if you eliminate that glass shard and it does not go back to the jury, there's not a reasonable likelihood or a reasonable probability that the outcome of this case would have been different. First-degree murder... with or without that particular...
It's a good thing this wasn't a Tyco case.
Yeah.
With that shard. You know, the Tyco case with the problem juror.
I'm not sure that I follow, Your Honor.
Jury number...
The one juror that's a holdout. After several days, somebody might be tempted to use the shard.
Right. That's a...
Well, I suppose that's true. However, I don't think that there's anything in the record that would suggest that in fact happened in this case.
No, apparently not. They all came out.
Right. Returning to the default argument, if this court were to conclude that the district court was incorrect in its procedural default rulings, this court's general rule is that it will then remand the case back to the district court so that the district court has the first opportunity to address the claims on the merits. I would just point out that notwithstanding that general rule, it's our position that this case presents the appropriate circumstances to deviate from that rule if this court is so inclined to do so. And I make that statement based on the interrelated nature of the claims. The claims that have been deemed defaulted have been briefed out before this court through the lens of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel. So they're very interrelated. Again, the parties have briefed it. This court has the underlying state court record. So notwithstanding that general rule, if this court were inclined to address those claims on the merits, it's our position that would be appropriate. I'd just like to make one point in response to opposing counsel's initial argument, if I may. Petitioner appears to be willing to concede that the other crimes evidence would have come in, that there wouldn't have been any way of keeping that evidence out. From their perspective...
I don't think she conceded that.
Okay, well...
I did.
If she didn't concede it, then the point of her argument is that counsel didn't put forth the proper effort that counsel should have.
That's what you said.
If that's the case, then that's an admission that there is no Strickland prejudice here. There's no reasonable probability that the outcome of the trial would have been different, and certainly there's no reasonable probability that the outcome of direct appeal would have been different had these issues been raised.
Okay, is that it?
That's it.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Weaver. Ms. Kostolecki, how much time does she have? 1 minute? Uh-huh. Anything further?
In response to the procedural default argument, the district court has not decided the merits of this matter, and both the post-conviction court and the court deciding the Finley motion have. And therefore, at a minimum, this case needs to be remanded to the district court for a decision on the merits. Alternatively, it could be remanded to the state trial court for a new trial based on the arguments raised in the brief and discussed here. Secondly, with respect to the glass shard, it should definitely not have gone back to the jury. In most of the cases discussing weapons going back to the jury, the weapon is allowed to go back when it is the weapon used in the incident or when it's a uniform, for example, used in the incident, not when it's something that's related to an incident that occurred multiple years prior to that.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And you were appointed, were you not? So we thank you for your efforts on behalf of this client. Next case for argument.